Well, I thought that we would start a short series talking about the Reformation. We've done this in the past. We've had different members of our church give presentations on different characters from the Reformation, so I figured we would do that as well. So the next several weeks, you'll get people other than me in Sunday school, and they will present on the life of a certain reformer, his teachings, and why he might be important. And I think that we will probably be emphasizing some different names this time around. A few years ago we did this, and you got your Luther, your Calvin, your Knox, so we've sort of covered those foundational characters, and so this time around we'll probably be presenting some characters you may not be as familiar with, but are equally as important. And so since that was going to be coming up, I figured I would start us all off with a general overview, just to remind us. I'm sure we've all heard presentations on the Reformation several times, but it's always good to go back over some things, and I thought also I might give you a wide scope, a big picture of the whole of the movement, because many times when you think of the Reformation, you think of maybe Martin Luther or John Calvin, and you think of theology, you think of justification, but really, the Reformation was a political movement, it was a cultural movement, it had an arts movement that came out from it. It was a wide-reaching phenomenon, and it is true that it all started with the church, and it wouldn't have happened if it not been for Luther and his theological discovery, but it really isn't fair to limit it to what we think of today as church stuff. When I teach medieval history in high school, the kids all say, this feels like a church history class. Well, that's because there's no other way to teach the Middle Ages than to talk about the church. And the same thing with the Reformation. The church just was the engine for the community. And so when it changed, everything else changed. The start of the Reformation is traditionally dated at October 31st, 1517. Now, who can tell me what is significant about October 31st?
Halloween.
Halloween, that's right. Now, why might Martin Luther have chosen Halloween to start this thing off? It started with his 95 Theses, of course, which were protesting or criticizing purgatory. That was specifically what he was criticizing in the beginning, purgatory. So what might Halloween have to do with purgatory? Any ideas?
What? Talking to ghosts.
Close. Before it was Halloween, it's not stated before, but the more churchly name for it was what? All Hallows Eve, which translates into all, it's the day before All Saints Day. So All Saints Day was the occasion. And so we're talking about purgatory on All Saints Day. So you can see how it kind of connects. Luther thought that that would be a symbolic day to bring up this disputation. Because he's talking about the fate of those Christians after they die. You know, where are the saints currently and what are they doing? So it's kind of neat that he chose that day on purpose. But when he chose that day, he didn't have anything more in mind than a public debate. This was going to be a college activity where they would have a public disputation. And he probably assumed that it would end rather quickly and probably raise a few eyebrows, cause a few books maybe to be written, but he didn't have in his mind a giant movement that he was going to overthrow all of Europe. In fact, if you read Luther's original theses, he's still very much a Catholic. In the 95 Theses, he believes in the papacy. He mostly believes in Catholic theology. I mean, you can tell the seeds are already there where he's going to make the break. But he's very particular. He's only talking about purgatory. And in fact, it took him being reprimanded by the papacy before he started really thinking, maybe there's more to this problem than I originally thought. In fact, you've seen the movie Luther that came out several years ago. Very good movie. You can see this. You know, he writes this letter to the Pope thinking, no, I thought that you would like to know that certain preachers are saying all these bad things, and I thought you would like to know that because I know you don't believe them. You know, that's the way he started off talking to the Pope, and it was not until he got the bad news that actually, in fact, the Pope was supporting the errors that Luther had to have a bigger plan. Now, I gave you a map, and I know that it's hard to see because it's black and white, but it shows you all the different groups of people. This is also helpful to see the big picture. You have Catholicism, which was the default. Everybody would have been considered a Catholic. And Luther himself would have thought of himself as a Catholic who was reforming the Catholic Church. Never in Luther's lifetime did he say, I'm leaving the Catholic Church. I'm getting rid of the Catholic Church. I'm starting a new church. No. That's very important. Luther always thought he was a true son of the Catholic Church, and he was making internal reforms. Now, it came to a point where he fully realized that the leadership had kicked him out, and at that point he said that they were the false. They were false leadership. You know, he never gave up that he was the true Catholic Christian. He was the real heir to all church history. He never gave that up, and that's important. So the default position was Catholic, and then you see where the Lutherans pop up, right in the middle of what's called the Holy Roman Empire. And they move quickly north into Scandinavia, Denmark, Norway, Sweden. You have Calvinists in Switzerland, the Netherlands, Scotland, parts of France. And of course, most of your Calvinists at the time would not have called themselves Calvinists. They would have just thought they were doing the same thing in a different part of town. It was only later that these names were applied. And so that's helpful that it really was a one, there are different flavors, but it was a single wave going across the continent. And then you get the Anglicans, and of course most Anglicans would have thought they were Calvinists if you had put this, I pulled this map off the internet, and I couldn't find one that was exactly satisfactory. This was the best. But if you read the original Church of England thinkers, they're quoting Calvin and Luther, and they're just, again, doing the same thing in England. The Church of England has had a checkered history. It kind of shifts from side to side. But the original reformers in England were definitely on the same page as Luther and Calvin. And so that's England and part of Ireland. And you've got some other movements as well. But it was giants. Now, what do you notice about this map? How much of it is unaffected? Let me ask it that way. It would be a minority, right? There's parts of Spain, parts of Italy that are unaffected, but everything else is affected. And that's what I wanted to show you. I mean, this is everywhere. And much of what we think of today as the modern world, is directly impacted by all of this. Everyone coming to America is already impacted by this. If they're Catholics, they're coming to America, with a mission to make sure only the Catholic Church is here. If they're reformers of various stripes, they've got the same idea. America is completely affected by all of this. Technology as well. The printing press has just come out, and so books are being printed very quickly. And most of the books are in the service of religious disputes or new Bibles. How about that? That was the biggest thing printed.
I think that just shows why we shouldn't allow people to read and should only be top-down information.
That's right. And you wouldn't have all this mess, right? Apparently no one would read. That was all part of it. Originally, the printing press was a threat. It was a potential danger to the leadership. But in many ways, it's like the internet today. We talked about the internet a few weeks ago, how you want to be careful with it, but you don't want to forbid it. Anybody that's forbidding the latest technology, you've got bad precedents. You've got bad forefathers if you go that road and say, oh, if we let people write things on the internet, then it'll just be wide open market. Well, that's what they said about the books. If we let people print books, man, anything's going to get out there. So the reformers were definitely in the middle of all of that. Now, who are they? Well, I gave you some. I could have given you books on how many reformers there were. There were tons of them. But here are the most well-known ones. Martin Luther, of course, in Germany. Ulrich Zwingli, maybe not as familiar, but he's in Switzerland. And he is just as important as Luther. He's not as popular because he was kind of a crank and didn't leave us the same things that Luther left us. Not as many things that we just love about Zwingli, but he was certainly out there leading the way. And he claimed to be independent of Luther. You know, he claimed to have discovered Luther down the road after he was already believing Reformed theology. And Zwingli is before Calvin. So the way to understand Zwingli, he's sort of a Calvin before Calvin with some issues that Calvin's going to change. But they were seen to be in the same line. Now, how about this next one? Henry VIII. Anybody think of him as a reformer? Well, he's a messy character, isn't he? A lot of television and movie play about Henry VIII lately. He's got lots of movies about Elizabeth more than Henry, but you get to see Henry. But there was that TV series, The Tudors, came on Showtime, and it was a little racy, and that's how they got to attract people. So I'm just going to show you the dirty side of The Tudors. But they portray Henry as this young guy, lots of mistresses, very boastful, and that was fairly accurate. That's kind of how he was. But he did start the Reformation in England. Now, it's messy, and he wouldn't have told you he was doing the same thing Luther was doing. Very, very different. In fact, he got his start criticizing Luther. The King of England, to this very day, is referred to as Defender of the Faith. Well, that started with Henry. The Pope named Henry Defender of the Faith because he had written books against Martin Luther. But a couple of years later, Henry wants a divorce. And you could make an argument that he should have gotten it. If you look into it, it's not so easy. And the Pope won't give it to him. And so they break away from the papacy. But it's not long until Henry is surrounded by Protestant churchmen. And so say what you want about Henry the man having problems, never being truly a Protestant himself. But he had the option to filter and pick who he would put in charge of the Church of England. And he put in there all the people that would make it a Protestant church, notably Thomas Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer gives us mostly the Book of Common Prayer, the 39 articles, though those took a while to get finished. He gives us what we know today as Anglicanism. And Henry picked him, handpicked him, and defended him. And there's this great sort of story where Henry has been told that his archbishop is a Protestant. He goes and confronts Cranmer about this, you know, and he's talking to Cranmer. Are these things true? And Cranmer, you know, speaks in the third person. He says, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the archbishop is none of these things. You know, he wiggles his way around it, but he kind of winks, too. That's how that's sort of the illustration. He kind of winks about it. And Henry understands by the end of his life that Cranmer is basically a Protestant. And Cranmer takes the Church of England in a Protestant direction. Henry's son, he doesn't live very long, but he lives for a few years, Edward VI. He's got Calvin writing him letters. He's got John Knox in the Church of England for a while. So definitely on the same page. Then you have Calvin in Geneva and Knox in Scotland. We know about that. But again, I want to show you the diversity. That's why you've got Germany, you've got Switzerland, you've got England, Scotland. And you also have people coming out of Italy, out of Spain. You have people in Hungary. There's a Transylvanian Reformed Church. Pretty cool, huh? I know a guy who lives in Tennessee and he translates all the Hungarian literature into English for the Reformed Church. So they're out there. Now, what was it all about? We've all heard the five solas, sola scriptura, scripture alone, meaning scripture alone is the foundation of religious belief, not that scripture is the only book ever, but for religion, for finding dogma, finding that which you have to believe. Scripture is the only source. Sola fide, faith alone is how a man is made right with God. Sola gratia, grace alone. Solus Christus, through Christ alone. And solo Deo gloria, glory to God alone. Those are the theological things, and that's what we're familiar with. We've heard that before. But I wanted to tell you there's so much more. It was about churches. Change in church organization. Who's in charge of the church? How should the church be thought of? And the big deal was, is the church the people, or is the church the structure, the institution, the hierarchy? That was the big difference. And for Luther and Calvin and all of the reformers, the church was the people. And this is important. If you want to know the mind of the church, where do you go? How do you find out? And it's always a threat that you just look at a couple of key leaders. We want to know the mind of the church. We'll ask the Pope. We'll ask the bishop. We'll ask, you know, maybe the pastor of the biggest church in town. And they can speak for the church. But the Reformers said, no, it's the entire people of God. And that would be important for what happened, for the outbreak of activity by regular people, ordinary life. Also emphasizing personal holiness and morality. You know, Luther goes to Rome and he is appalled because he sees monks shacking up with prostitutes. And he goes and asks the bishop if he knows about this. And the bishop's like, of course. That's Rome. Everybody knows that. They pay taxes. We make money off of this. So, yes, personal holiness. That's also important. And, of course, the priesthood of all believers. And if all believers are priests, then that means all believers need to be praying. All believers need to be in the worship. And all believers need to be thinking of themselves as directly in front of God. And so we have to write new prayers. And they've got to be in the vernacular. Before the Reformation, all of your prayers are in Latin. And most people didn't know what they meant. It's still that way if you talk to older Catholics, people that were going to Catholic churches before the 1960s, 1950s, they can tell you that they would go in and it was completely in Latin and you may not have known a word of it. You probably picked up a few of them as you went on, but you didn't really know. You just sat there. So the new prayers had to be written there for everybody and they had to be in a language you can speak. And everybody did that, even the Church of England. We think of the Church of England as being very showy and high church, but it was still in English, wasn't it? Church of England services are never in Latin, so they're always in the vernacular. So they were also on board with this. Politics and law. Got to talk about this with the Reformation. The papacy was a political institution. There was a video game called Medieval Total War, and there was a Roman Total War. And you would play as these various kings. And it was always funny, in the medieval game, one of your rival people was the papacy. And he could attack you, and he'd have his armies, and you'd have to go to war against him. Well, that's actually true. You know, they weren't making that up. That was based on reality. The Pope had armies, and it was called the Papal States. And he could call crusades against you, for political purposes. If you are out of line with the Pope, you might get a crusade called against you. Not good. So the Reformation brought an end to that. And there was no single political system. We've got to be honest about this. You know, some people make the argument the Reformation was all about democracy or something. Well, that's really not sustainable. There were monarchies, there were representative governments, even empires. The King of England wanted to be thought of as an emperor, and Luther would have been happy had the Holy Roman Empire become a Lutheran. He would have been okay with that. So there was no single system, but they did emphasize reason and natural law, which are going to be big deals for America, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created with certain inalienable rights. Well, that language had a history, you know. Today, what does it mean to be self-evident? We don't even know. But back then, it meant that you know these things. You can look out both at the Bible and the reality and tell right from wrong, basically. And you know when you're being done wrong. And they thought there was also a law of nature. That was not a way to get out of religion either. That was just a way to say, God made us this way. You know, our rhetoric is still like that, you know, with the marriage debate. We talk about homosexual marriage being unnatural, but no one really knows what that means anymore. But at the time of the Reformation, they're emphasizing, no, there is such a thing as nature. God made it this way, and you can't get out of it. try as you might, you can't. It's nature. You can't make yourself not a human. You can try, but it's not going to work. And they emphasize that particularly to allow for politics to operate without having bishops in charge of it. That was the big deal. You know, if there's no such thing as, if you can't decide right from wrong without getting help from the church, the argument went, no one can do this job except for the clergy. And so it was not a de-religion argument, but it was a validity of different jobs. That's what I think of it. It's okay to have a king who's a good king. He doesn't have to go through somebody else. And there are some famous thinkers associated with this. Not all great guys, but important guys nonetheless. Some of them are great guys. Thomas Hobbes, from Calvin and Hobbes. Well, that's where they got the name. But he wrote The Leviathan. He was basically a Protestant. People argue about that, but he was loyal to the Church of England. And if you read Hobbes, I don't recommend it for everybody, but if you were to read Hobbes, the big deal for Hobbes is that the politics, the government, is based on a covenant. I had to read this at Southern Miss, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Covenant. I've heard that word before. Well, he got that from the religious conversation, or both of them were getting it from the same place, the Bible. And so Hobbes says the king and the people are held together via covenant. So if nothing else about Hobbes, if you don't like anything else about him, at least he had that basic point right on, that we are held together by a covenant. Then John Locke, famous for America, probably the single most influential thinker for America. He was mostly a Protestant Christian. I think he had his rough edges, but if you would have asked him, he would have said he was a Protestant Christian. And they've discovered in Locke tremendous amounts of direct quotations from Richard Hooker, The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity, who was very much a Protestant churchman. So Locke, right here. And then Hugo Grotius, who maybe not as well known, but Hugo Grotius is famous for his writings on war. And he's writing during the Wars of Religion. And he said, basically, well, just because it's war doesn't mean you get to go on a rampage. There's still right and wrong in war. And so he writes about how Christians can go to war and do it justly. And that's probably very important for us today to rediscover that. Just because it's wartime doesn't mean you can do anything. And how often do you hear people say that, right? Let's just nuke them all. Let's just bomb them all. I found that from a lot of evangelical Christian high schoolers. That was the default assumption. Once it's wartime, you just smash everybody. Well, Grotius said, we still have to be Christians here too. We still have to follow general laws of civility. Now, vocation is the word for job, but this was huge too. The Reformation said, every calling is holy. Every job is holy. And what they didn't mean by that is that you need to turn your job into a pulpit and you just be a preacher. They didn't mean that. You know, they did not mean a Christian school teacher is one who only teaches Bible classes. Or a Christian mechanic is going to pull you aside from the car and start evangelizing. Well, maybe if that is appropriate, but that's not what they meant by a holy call. They meant if you are a cobbler, and that's sort of Luther's favorite term. It means shoemaker. He said, go out and be the best shoemaker possible and do it for God's glory. All callings are holy, meaning go out and do those callings. This is a big confusion in America. Christians want to say, be a cop for Christ. And what they mean by that is, take time to stop doing your police work and start doing some sort of Christian-y stuff, churchy stuff. Tell devotionals and, you know, sit people aside. But that's actually not what the Reformers meant. They meant go out and do your job well and with gratitude, with a heart of charity, and be the best at that job. Because the world needs all of these professions. You know, a Christian school, according to the Reformers, would be a school that taught the humanities well and taught mathematics well and taught science well. It would not be a school that turned everything into a Bible class. If you turn everything into a Bible class, you're really saying the most holy thing, the best thing, is church work, you know, church proper. Well, their whole point was, no, everything is good and holy. And I think that's really worth recovering. Martin Luther says, a cobbler, again, he's a shoemaker, a smith, a peasant, every man has the office and function of his calling, and yet all alike are consecrated priests and bishops. And every man should, by his office, that is, his job, be useful and beneficial to the rest, so that various kinds of work may all be united for the furtherance of body and soul. Every job, doing that job well, working together. And then, of course, be a cobbler to the glory of God, right? No job is too small or too insignificant. And where do you think he's getting that? Just think biblically. What New Testament passage would that
be? He's getting that from Martin Luther King Jr.
Close. No. If you had to think of a New Testament passage that talks about different types of people and not looking down on other types of people. Any guesses? What is it?
Tax collector.
Okay. Think about particularly an illustration Paul is talking. I'll give that much away. There's different kinds of things.
Should the eye say to the hand?
The eye say to the hand. That's right. That's in 1 Corinthians. The body has many members. So Luther he's basically paraphrasing Paul. That's what he's doing here. He's moving it from simply, you know, church role to all Christians in their life. But go out and do what you're supposed to do. And another big deal about the Reformation was the deacons. In the Catholic Church, a deacon is an understudy to the priest. You know, that's what he does. But the Reformation really tried to recover the diaconate as a public servant, and particularly in hospitals and almsgiving. I looked up the city of Geneva, and they're writing up their offices for the church, and they went through all the offices, teachers, pastors, elders, and they get to deacons, and it's like the deacons need to start a hospital. That's their job. Half of them start a hospital, half of them go around the city giving out alms to the poor. That's what they thought deacons were. And you can imagine, if that was done well, that would make a big impact, wouldn't it? Your church has an entire arm known for serving the poor and the sick. And in those days, there probably was only one or two churches in the city. And so that would be your primary sort of health care, welfare system. That was a big deal. They really emphasized that. The Catholics are known for having good hospitals now, but that, you know, that wasn't, they came sort of as a result of their attempt to counter the Reformation, sort of outdo us. And sad to say, they did with the hospitals. I mean, not every single hospital, but, you know, you think of a religiously sponsored hospital today, probably going to be a Catholic hospital. But the Reformers were very big into that, and I think that's probably worth recovering as well. That's a part of the diaconal ministry. Calvin said it's not good to have beggars walking around town, but instead of just sort of crushing the beggars, you make sure they're having sort of a regular charity outlet from the church. That was a solution. Also, schools. Eric could probably tell us more about this, but everywhere they started a Reformed church, they started a school. That was just part of it. And they founded we would call them classical schools today. Back then, that was the only school. And they were to teach people the liberal arts, but also certain forms of math and science. There were new studies in, I'm always going to mess this up, astronomy. That's the one that you just study the stars, right? Not the horoscope. Yeah, astronomy. There were huge breakthroughs in astronomy at the same time as the Reformation. And many of these astronomers were Protestant. Kepler, I believe, was Copernicus also, or am I he's too early? But yeah, Johann Kepler, very famous Lutheran, right? Because he's German.
Well, he was actually persecuted for being a Calvinist.
A suspected closet Calvinist. There you go. So yeah, they were big into that too. And Calvin, writing to Geneva, he says that he's talking about how we're ever going to get educated people to lead our churches, and talking about educated people in the government. And he says, it's only possible to profit from such teaching if one is first instructed in languages. Now, what languages do you think he means?
Latin,
perhaps Greek, and then certain other European languages. Calvin, of course, spoke French. Humanities, that means books, literature, history. And because it is necessary to lay the foundations for the future, listen to that, a college should be instituted for the instructing of children to prepare them for the ministry as well as for civil government. Interesting that a college for children, it really turned out that you go to college, you know, in your teens, early teens, but that's what he means. In the first place, it should be suitable for accommodation. Suitable accommodation needs to be provided for the teaching of children and others who want to take advantage of it. We also need a literate, scholarly, and trained teacher who can take care of the establishment of their education. So he wants them to know languages and logic. That's very interesting. He writes this in their little church manual. And this is a book Calvin's giving out for how we're going to make our church. We need a school. And Christian schools have had a big revival. And I think that this is good. I think that they should exist. The church should be on the forefront of this. But they need to be good. You know, they really do need to be scholarly and literate. And they need to have emphasis on languages and humanities. That's all important. Because we need to lay a foundation for the future. He's saying we need a school so we can have smart and dependable leaders in church and civil government. Okay? Now, not to pick on any Christian school in particular, but we all kind of know what we think about the general Christian school at large. Do you think of that as a place where the next president is going to be going to school? Probably not. And that's too bad, right? It should be. That should be the goal and the ideal. Yes, Paul.
I think that all of these changes, though, of course, I don't know a whole lot about this, but it just seems that they're really bridging the world church divide.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the fundamental like change. It was like, if you're going to be educated, you got to be educated for God, and that means you have to be a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And then only priests and monks can teach other people. Right. Educated people, aka priests. And then they were saying, okay, we're going to be, you know, the president should be one of us.
That's right.
Everybody should be one of us. So.
And unfortunately, you know, what we've seen happen with conservative Christians today, we would never say we were making everybody be a priest in the old Catholic sense. But what we tend to do is we need to say everybody needs to be like a mini preacher. You know, that's sort of our flaw. And so instead of really emphasizing the best engineer or the best, you know, scientist, we turn those classes into Bible classes. And that's the real problem today. How do you do this where you are emphasizing biblical principles and morals and virtues, but you're not sucking the real virtue of the study out of it? I know that that's always a problem. Eric and I, we talk about this a lot. We're trying to do Christian high school curriculum. And it's not anybody in particular's fault. I mean, the books we're using, the expectations of the parents, the students, it just tends to be that every lecture, you know, you need to end with a little devotional, or you need to spin it into a certain sort of Bible passage. And over time, you feel like you can't emphasize the subject as the subject. And that's the big problem. But at the Reformation, they didn't. That wasn't something they had to even worry about. That split for them, being the best shoemaker was being a Christian shoemaker. Like that was. Those were the same thing. Being a virtuous and successful king, that's what you want. And it was just assumed that that would be compatible with being Christian. Also, literature. We've got the printing press now. We've got vernacular. That means your own language, language you can understand. And so we're going to start making books. That's what happens. Sacred literature is a big deal. The Luther Bible. It's the first whole book written in German. And the Luther Bible really serves to make a single German language. That's one of the founding books, the way all German people could unite, because there was no such thing as Germany back then, just little sub pockets. In English, you have the Book of Common Prayer and the King James Bible. Now, few of us in here think of the Book of Common Prayer as something we were raised on, but there's at least one part of it that every one of you know and every one of you would expect as natural. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to join this man and woman in matrimony. The whole wedding service, the till death do us part, you know, that is all from the Book of Common Prayer. The American marriage ceremony, which is becoming the normal international ceremony as it's exported, is from the Book of Common Prayer. That's where it comes from. And so it's part of our fabric, whether we know it or not. It was just that influential. The King James Bible, also, that did for us what Luther's Bible did for Germany. It established the English language. And it used to be that every person, every English-speaking person had at least one book, and it was the King James Bible. Typically, they had that book, and then they had Pilgrim's Progress. John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. You count on those books. It was huge. And the King James Bible, I mean, that's just what we think of when we think of, thus saith the Lord. You know, you picture Charlton Heston quoting the King James Bible. It's in our fabric. But that's all part of the Reformation. Also, John Milton, Paradise Lost. He was a Church of England thinker, a little fishy, obviously got in trouble for his loose views on divorce, among other things, but still a great writer. Edmund Spenser, the Fairy Queen, had to read that in high school, really weird, but an allegory for Queen Elizabeth. William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare is completely a biblical Protestant Christian. Not that he never, you know, got a little racy or a little dirty, but you can't read his books without, and understand them without getting the biblical background. I actually was just reading an essay on Hamlet, and I didn't know this. I mean, I didn't have the tools at the time, but Hamlet, a big problem in Hamlet is that the king who's killed, his brother marries his wife, and his brother's trying to claim that he is fulfilling a Nazarite role. And, of course, that doesn't work because the brother already had a kid, Hamlet. But she's like, whoa, a Nazarite role in Shakespeare. I never thought about it before, but this article is pointing out all the quotations from Leviticus and Deuteronomy. I'm like, wow, I mean, this is really a part of Shakespeare. The Merchant of Venice. Anyone read The Merchant of Venice? There was a movie with Al Pacino. Amanda, give us the gist of The Merchant of Venice. What's it about? The pound of flesh. Yeah.
The Jewish merchant has lost the money and now he wants it paid back. The guy doesn't have the means to pay him back, so he says he'll take it in the pound of he'll take his bit in flesh. Mm-hmm. It is taken to court. The judge is actually his girlfriend in disguise, and he said, "You can have the pound of flesh as long as you know how to take the blood." Mm-hmm. And he wasn't happy except for the poor Jewish merchant.
And now that book, it comes under criticism because it's seen as being anti-Semitic. And it probably is by modern standards. But in Shakespeare's mind, the Jews, that was a way of bringing back old, you know, Bible imagery. The Jews persecuting someone in court. You know, he broke, the guy really was guilty. You know, he breaks the agreement. And so he has to give up a pound of flesh, which of course would kill the guy. So, you know, your life is demanded from you. And then the judge, who is secretly his wife, well, I mean, you could reverse that, say the wife or his girlfriend, you know, and you say, well, to reverse that, the wife, you know, the bridegroom stepping in. It's not that hard to get that connection there. Stepping in to defend him. I mean, it's not just an allegory. It's not an allegory, but it's deeply wedded to the Christian story, right? You have broken your agreement, really. You owe this, and then the judge himself comes to your rescue. I mean, you know, that's all part of it. Shakespeare is steeped in this stuff. And, you know, most schools don't even know enough to tell you that. But it's true that he's all about that. And he is emphasizing many of the same themes. And then, of course, John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress. John Bunyan was a Baptist minister in England, Reformed Protestant, and that's one of the most famous books in the English language, Pilgrim's Progress, all coming out of this movement. So a big literary thing. And also music. We don't think about the Reformation having music, but it did. Thomas Tallis is well known in the Church of England. But also there are Calvinist musicians. Can you get this ready and play track two? The Calvinists, of course, translated the Psalms, and they put them to music, and they would go around singing them. And this guy, Claude Goudimel, actually set the Genevan Psalms to some really impressive musical scores, and I actually have a CD of them. Now, this is Psalm 13 for the Genevan Psalter in French. Now, obviously, it's still very, you know, classically.
This is Goudimel.
Goudimel, he's the composer. But he's getting it from the Genevan Psalter, which was Calvin. Yes. And, you know, this is not music that we feel normal and natural with, but it was influential, it was famous. I actually was given the CD by a Catholic guy. He was, you know, he's a very high, artsy kind of guy. He said, "I've got something you might like." And he pulls it off. Thanks. And it says, "The Psalms of the Reformation." Psalms of the French Reformation, Claude Goudimel. And so it is out there. You can do that on Pandora. That'd be the best way to check it out. Pandora, Claude Goudimel. But the thing about the song, the French, is they are giving you the songs and music. And so even if that sounds a little weird to us, what that did was it got in the average person's head. And so they were going around singing songs. And that is a very helpful teaching tool, because then you'll end up learning the Psalms. Musical innovations. Well, congregational singing, that's the big one, letting the people sing. And again, modern evangelicals are kind of going the wrong way with some of this. Now the big thing is to have on-stage performances, professional bands and soloists. But the Reformers are all about getting the people to sing. The Germans really, I don't know if they invented, but they definitely made the chorales a popular form of music, and they had all their people singing. And Luther was really interested in singing. He was known for very good music. Luther was a well-trained musician with a good voice. He played the lute. He wrote hymns, and most of them were versions of psalms. And a lot of Luther's stuff was, it was bouncy. It was sort of something you could dance to a little bit. Now, he wasn't taking music from the bar. That's often told folktale. Luther used bar tunes. But actually, that expression bar tune has referred to the music, the bar on the paper. It wasn't he was taking music from the bars. But a lot of his stuff sounds like folk music because he was in tune, I think, with the people. And so, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God" originally was, "A mighty fortress is our God, a trusty shield and weapon." That was how it originally, it was in German, but that was the original tune. And we haven't completely lost it. We slow it way down. "A mighty fortress." And that's a fine song. I like it. But the original, you can tell, had a different spirit to it. And you can imagine people actually humming that along. The Psalms, the Genevan Psalms, some of them are tough. But, you know, "Now Israel may say in that in truth, had not the Lord on our right maintained." You know, it has a little bit of a something you could go around singing, and you could imagine that getting in people's heads and inspiring people. Now, it's all part of the point. Psalters in the language you could see. You would know the Psalms. And then the English, we don't think of plain song chant as being user-friendly, but it was at the time. It was much more user-friendly than the previous forms. Now, Luther has some great stuff on music, and I can't read it all, but, you know, he says, "I'm not of the opinion that all arts are to be cast down on account of the gospel, as some fanatics suggest." Well, he's talking about the Anabaptists and some of the more extreme members of the Reformation. "On the other hand, I would gladly see all art, especially music, in the service of Him who has given and created them." Luther was very interested in music. "We must teach music in schools." He who has skill in music will always be of good temperament, fit for all things. A schoolmaster ought to have skill in music, or I would not regard him. Neither should we ordain young men as preachers unless they have been well taught in music. Man, this guy is interested and committed to this, right? He thinks it's a big deal. Why say it if you can sing it? That was one of his expressions. Why say it if you can sing it? And he was very interested in that. And I think that is a great legacy. And it is worth recovering and emulating. And I think our church has done a lot in that respect. When I came here, I was definitely impressed that, you know what, people sing. And if we're good or mediocre, we're still singing, which is a world of difference from where I was brought up. I was brought up that the men kind of look at the floor and they quietly mumble, but they don't do anything more than that. And so we want to sing. We want to encourage singing. Get out there. And it's funny, if you start singing, just even basic, just general singing, and you go to another church, people are going to say, wow, you're really good. Man, you can sing. I've been in my own wedding, but also when I was a groomsman at Eric's wedding, we had music, and so I just sang. And people came up to me and said, wow, you were really singing that stuff. And I thought, well, not really. I was only singing that stuff. I wasn't doing anything special. But just the fact that I was singing at a fairly audible level was new. Wow. Because we've gotten so far away from that. We should recover it. Music is a big deal. It's all over the Bible. King David playing the harp, chasing away evil spirits. You know, it's our one of our strongest weapons. So I'll stop there. Any questions, comments? All right, well, we'll have more people to come in the next couple of weeks presenting on particular men of the Reformation and at least one woman. So keep coming. We'll continue with this. Okay, let me close this in prayer. Dear Lord, we do thank you for the heritage that we have and we have sometimes forgotten, and we ask that you would remind us and you would inspire us. This would be fun. This would be encouraging. This would be worthwhile to learn of our forefathers in the faith and what they have learned from your word. Bless us that we would always be respectful of that, and even where we might disagree, we would do so in charity as children do to their forefathers. Bless us now as we go forth to worship you. Teach us to sing, teach us to play music, to praise you, and to worship in spirit and truth. All in your name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.